You might call my talk today the retarding of agriculture instead of the march of agriculture. With marching, we think of advancement. But with the subject I've chosen, there's no progress. There never is with fire. No doubt most of you have seen the huge torch of a flaming barn pressed against the night sky, or felt the awful heat of a fire that's consuming tons of expensive hay and grains. And probably you've watched the pained, fear-struck eyes of livestock which are trapped in a blazing barn or shed. And if you've seen these things, then you've known the expression on the face of a farmer, perhaps a neighbor or friend, as he watches years of hard work and saving going up in a few brief moments of smoke. In seeing his bowed head and hopeless eyes, you felt a part of the empty helplessness that's smothering him, that's making him afraid of what is ahead. Or worse yet, maybe you've watched the quick destruction of a beautiful old farm home, filled with memories and good things and the comfort that only farm homes have. Worst of all, perhaps someone you know or someone dear to you has lost his life in one of these farm tragedies. They're occurring all the time, you know. Millions of dollars worth of property is being destroyed, and people are losing their lives, victims of ever-increasing fires. From 1942 through 1947, 734 people died in or as a result of fires in Iowa. Last year, there were 117 such victims. In 1946, 119 people gave their lives in Iowa's fires. That was more than the number of deaths which resulted from common diseases. In that same year, 9 people died from scarlet fever, 16 from whooping cough, 22 from measles, 16 from diphtheria, and 53 from polio. That's 116 deaths from 5 different diseases, while fire, which can be prevented, took 119 lives. Studies made by the Iowa Agricultural Experiment Station reveal that 3 out of every 4 farmers risk their lives, their families, their property, and investments by allowing unnecessary fire hazards to exist around their farms. Yes, fire really can be prevented. How? Listen to this list of causes. According to statistics, 60% of all farm fires in the winter occur in farm homes. The chief causes for these farm fires are defective flues and heating systems, sparks on combustible roofs, careless use of matches and cigarettes, improper use of gasoline and kerosene, unsafe stoves and furnaces, and misuse of electricity and appliances. These studies show that the greatest cause for farm home fires is defective construction. Inspection is the answer. Experienced inspectors can find faulty construction quickly and advise what must be done, but the farmer himself can recognize and remove most of these hazards. The other causes, which I mentioned, can be summed up in one word, carelessness. A little thoughtfulness, a few precautionary steps are all that are needed to overcome these hazards. Iowa State College farm safety specialist Norval Wardle has suggested a 7-point program for effective protection against fires. This program includes regular general cleaning and repair of the heating system, regular checks on electrical equipment and wiring, cleanliness in storage spaces and unused rooms, proper storage of gasoline and other combustibles and metal drums, and keeping firefighting equipment handy. 30% of Iowa's total farm fire loss in summer comes from barn fires. A large percentage of these barn fires is caused by spontaneous combustion of hay which has been put in the barn while it's too green. Other chief causes are inadequate protection against lightning, carelessness with matches and cigarettes, and poor electrical wiring and equipment. A number of other hazards which are common around farm buildings are weeds, brush, old lumber, and refuse. What must be done is clear. Prevention simply is removing the cause. An investment in carefulness now pays and will pay big dividends in the future. The nation's annual farm fire loss totals $90 million. An average of 3,500 people die each year in our country as a result of farm fires. If you've seen a farm fire tragedy, you'll understand the importance of this message. If you haven't, be thankful, and take every step to be sure you're not the farmer who stands watching his own loss. Agriculture is marching forward, is noting progress every day, but all the advancements gained are worth nothing while the threat of fire exists. Prevention is your investment. Precaution and care, your contributions, both to yourself and to the continuing march of agriculture.
Today we pause in the march of agriculture to discuss education and how the one-room country school fits into the school district reorganization plans which are taking place in many areas. Evidently, the little red or white school is not vanishing completely, but it is evident that they are not increasing in numbers. Right now, the nation has about 75,000 such schools with only one teacher, and most of them are located in rural areas. Generally speaking, and according to many reports, the most expensive way for a state to give a child an education is in a small school. This is pointed up by a report from the Council of State Governments. It's the first study of the United States education that's been made by an agency representing all the states. The Council report says there are immense differences within many states in the quality and cost of education offered children. These differences exist not only between rural and city schools, but also between different rural schools and between different city schools. In some states, the cost per pupil of operating some schools is 10 times or more what it is for other schools. The report says that in Colorado, for example, the operating cost per pupil in one rural district is $39, but in another is $838. And in Wyoming, they claim the student with the most costly elementary schooling among all the school districts that report such costs. In one school in Wyoming, with only one student, the annual cost is $1,773. New York State has a school with only three students. The cost per pupil is $1,050. The report says it unquestionably is necessary to provide small schools in many isolated communities, but the expense of 75,000 one-teacher schools is not justified because of geographic conditions or for any other reason. Says the report, the state with the largest number one-teacher schools is not, as might be expected, one of the more sparsely settled states, but the relatively densely populated state of Illinois, which reports 6,778 one-teacher schools. Iowa, Minnesota, Missouri, Nebraska, and Wisconsin have over 4,000 one-teacher schools each. In contrast, Utah reports only 28 such schools, and Rhode Island has only 26. Discussing recommendations by the National Commission on School District Reorganization, the report says the commission offers these rules. First, enrollment in kindergarten and grades 1 to 6 should not be fewer than 175 pupils with 7 teachers. Second, junior and senior high school enrollment should not be fewer than 300 pupils with 12 teachers. And third, elementary pupils should not be required to travel more than 45 minutes and high school pupils not more than an hour each day between home and school. The council says there is evidence a good education program cannot be offered in high schools of less than 100 pupils except at excessive cost. And yet there are 9,000 high schools with fewer than 100 pupils in the United States. Among these 9,000, there are 3,750 with fewer than 50 pupils. The council says that many states have a high percentage of districts too small to meet any reasonable standard of operating efficiency. What is worse, many have laws that actually encourage districts too small for economy or good education programs. Discussing the training of teachers, the report says a number of states have lower qualification standards for rural teachers than for teachers in city schools. It adds, for example, Missouri specifies only 8 semester hours of college preparation for an approved rural school, but the requirement jumps to 60 hours for an elementary school in a high school district and to 120 hours for an elementary school where it is combined with a high school. It adds that if any distinction is made, it should require more training for teachers in isolated areas where they are without benefit of supervision or adequate teaching aids. Now, we're not advocating the closing of all one-room rural schools. As the report pointed out, in many areas, there is no other way for children to receive their education. But we do urge a careful study of our education system, and especially in rural areas. The march of agriculture depends on these young people and their ability to meet problems along the way intelligently. We feel that improving educational opportunities is one way the march of agriculture can be continued.
Today's farming sets tomorrow's table. That's the catchy, clever, and meaningful title of a significant little leaflet recently prepared by H.E. Babcock, a noted American economist. The 8-page illustrated pamphlet is jam-packed with interesting statements, pictures, and charts, every one of which helps to stress the importance of this nation's March of Agriculture. The leaflet opens with a statement that 150 million people can't afford to take chances on tomorrow's meals, and then adds that if we could see behind the foods in the family refrigerator, we would find a lot of animals and poultry, hens, turkeys and ducks, pigs and sheep, beef cattle and dairy cattle, and that behind the livestock, we would see grass and forage and grain, even waste potatoes and surplus citrus fruits fed to animals. But the statement doesn't stop there. It goes on to say that back of the feed are the soil resources of the country. Eroded lands show up as skinny chops, the black soil of Iowa as a choice roast. Back of the bottle of milk is good grass and an early spring rain. Back of the pork chops is good yellow corn, used in the feedlot instead of hoarded in storage. Then Babcock makes the assertion that these are relationships the housewife, yes, everyone, must come to understand. He reiterates that today's farming sets tomorrow's table, and that an expanded animal agriculture is necessary to the American way of life as we like it. He emphasizes that the grow and go in American life come largely from animal products, highest quality bodybuilding proteins, protective foods, the vitamins A, B, and D, essential minerals like calcium and iron, all are served up to meet nutritional needs by animal agriculture. This is further underlined by the observation that the cream of the peaches, the butter on the biscuits, the gravy on the potatoes, the cheese on macaronis, the lightness in cake come from the land by way of animals. Animal foods are not only flavor foods in themselves, they're also the flavor ingredients in so many of the dishes that put the invitation to come and eat on American tables. Babcock then goes on to assert that animals also provide essential materials for many important industries, making things that American people need and want. Other interesting views in the leaflet are that grasslands, forage crops, and many byproducts of processing industries are going to waste in America every day. This suggests we need enough animals to turn these into human food. In addition, we must have enough livestock to convert and condense surpluses of grain and other foods suitable for direct human consumption into animal food products and into the leather, tankage, and fertilizer that are the byproducts of animal agriculture. Moreover, the publication considers an animal agriculture as the best hedge the grain grower can have on future markets. Babcock adds that the most practical food reserve our country can have is the maximum numbers of livestock and poultry. Comes a drought or a war, we can eat some of the livestock and poultry and release for human consumption the cereal the livestock was eating. As a conclusion for these various observations, the economist says the twin objectives of our national rural economy are the family farm and the secure farm family. In summing up the need for more stress on an animal economy, the leaflet explains that to provide adequately for 150 million people, we need 10 million more dairy cattle, 11 million more beef animals, 8 million more sheep, 20 million more hogs, and about 120 more chickens, geese, turkeys, and ducks. There may be some who will disagree with Babcock as to the increased numbers of stock and what they might do to prices, but he goes right on to say the planks needed in our national food and farm program include teaching the youth of America the importance of nutritious food, using modern selling techniques to adult Americans to the importance of good nutrition, hold foremost in the American policy the necessity of maximum conversion of waste foods, forage and surplus grains, keep foreign aid and foreign trade programs in line with a national policy that protects and encourages animal agriculture, aid both producers and consumers by helping families maintain adequate diets of proper food, substitute the forward-looking idea of soil building for the defensive idea of soil conservation, recognizing the importance of animals in this program, overhauling both private and public research in food and agriculture, and focusing more attention on marketing efficiently. This, then, is a blueprint to keep in mind as we think of today's farming in setting tomorrow's table, a pattern to help us in the march of agriculture.